Five, four, three, two, one.
I know you're gonna dig this.
Welcome to the Barrett Sports Media Podcast.
Think we could listen to the radio or something?
Radio? Who needs a radio?
Featuring the biggest names and newsmakers from the world of sports media.
Don't act like you're not impressed.
Now, here's your host, the president of Barrett Sports Media, Jason Barrett.
Greetings from the friendly confines of BSM headquarters located in beautiful upstate New York. I am Jason Barrett, and this is the eighth episode of season two of the Barrett Sports Media Podcast. Appreciate each of you taking the time to listen. As always, allow me to take a second to request your participation by leaving a review for the podcast on iTunes. It's a one-and-done exercise. It takes you no more than a few minutes. We do this show free of charge. Your support makes it possible. On today's episode, I'm thrilled to welcome Chris Carlin of Sports Radio WIP in Philadelphia to the podcast. We spent over an hour talking about his career in New York and the city of brotherly love, and I think you're going to find a number of the stories he shared to be very fascinating. That's coming up in a few minutes. But as we've learned, sports radio never takes a day off, and there have been a couple of news stories dominating the headlines lately, and yours truly does have a few opinions to offer on them. So without further ado, let's kick things off with this week's 5 and 5.
There are 5 minutes remaining.
Craig Carton has been suspended by WFAN after being arrested by federal authorities for allegedly taking part in a Ponzi scheme that fleeced investors of millions of dollars. It's a waste of a career, the end of a successful show, and it's a reminder of the power of addiction and how bad decision-making can cripple you no matter who you are or how important you might be. This now puts the fan in a vulnerable state, and it basically ends Carton's career, assuming he's found guilty and sent to prison. Priority number one for FAN should be to find a way to retain Mike Francesa. Blowing up two highly successful drive times at once is a recipe for disaster. Mike can tell the world he's done, but money talks, and if the Pope cares about the station as much as I think he does, then he knows the timing of his departure could not be worse. It would also help Entercom, who are in the process of a merger, retain confidence in the New York ad community. Who makes sense to fill Carton's spot? Well, there are a couple of names that are going to jump up. Brandon Tierney, Greg Giannotti, and Mike Valenti will all come to mind. The station could go outside the box with someone like Greg Hughes, who's otherwise known as Opie of ONA fame, or as the Daily News suggested, maybe a guy like Michael Rappaport enters the mix. Few programmers handle these situations better than Mark Chernoff, and I have no doubt he'll deliver again. Although at this point, I'm sure Mark would much rather prefer to not be in the situation in the first place. What a weird Sunday it was. Chris Berman was gone from ESPN, CBS's NFL studio show was different, and Tony Romo officially took over for Phil Simms alongside Jim Nantz. It's too early to tell if each of these moves will excite viewers on a long-term basis, but it felt strange. Many have killed Berman over the years for his hokey style and ridiculous nicknames, but there was something about Chris that just screamed, "It's time for football season." I can live with the changes on CBS's show, and as a Giants fan, while I appreciated Simms more than others, I understand the long-term benefit of turning to Romo. But not having Boomer lead ESPN's Sunday show felt awkward. Will those feelings subside in upcoming weeks? I'm not sure, but for now, my NFL pregame experience feels incomplete. And the Marconi for Sports Radio Station of the Year goes to Sports Radio 1310, The Ticket in Dallas. The Ticket faces stiff competition locally from 105.3 The Fan, but they've regained complete control of the local landscape in the ratings, often delivering double-digit performances. I thought the NAB this year chose five strong brands as nominees. The other four were WEEI and 98.5 The Sports Hub in Boston, 101 ESPN in St. Louis, and 97.5 The Fanatic in Philadelphia. A case could have been made for The Zone in Nashville or KFAN in Minneapolis, but I had no problem with the five who were selected. Congratulations, fellas, on a job well done. 590 The Fan KFNS in St. Louis has hired Frank O'Pinion to host afternoons after 20-plus years on News Talker KTRS. Except there's one small problem. The radio host openly admits knowing little about sports, which is usually a requirement for hosting a show on a sports station. But that doesn't seem to bother KFNS owner Randy Markle, who took to the Post-Dispatch to try and sell the public on opinion being the equivalent of Babe Ruth and Michael Jordan. KFNS's ratings are low, and 590 has churned through talent over the past years, plus Opinion makes his money by selling his own ad time. So the feeling is, why the hell not do something else? Having spent 5 years in St. Louis, I can tell you, Frank has talent and will bring some cachet to KFNS. But Markle has talked a big game since buying 590, and he's still yet to back any of it up. Will this be another case of blowing smoke, or has the station finally gotten it right? Only time will tell. 2 years ago, I was unsure if BSM would work, but I was determined to try. I didn't launch the business with a short-term mentality. I was hungry to build a niche and help the sports format tell its story while helping clients and individuals improve their performance. I didn't do this to become rich. I hoped it would simply pay the rent and keep my family happy. But now, sitting here 2 years later, it's done that and then some, and I can't thank my clients and supporters enough for sticking with me. This isn't a space where many can succeed. I'm just fortunate to have been one of the lucky ones. Celebrating a 2-year anniversary means a lot to me, and I appreciate you guys for believing in the product. And that, my friends, brings the 5 and 5 this week to a close. Feel free to share your thoughts with me on any of those topics. You can do so either through Twitter at SportsRadioPD or via email at jbarrett@sportsradiopd.com. We've arrived at the point of the podcast where the focus becomes our featured guest, and this week I'm thrilled to welcome Chris Carlin to the show. The Continent, as he's affectionately known in sports radio circles, entertains Philadelphia sports radio fans weekday afternoons on WIP alongside former NFL linebacker Ike Reese. Chris and I have never worked together, but we have known each other for over 15 years. In fact, I interviewed with Chris and Eddie Scazzeri in late 2003 for a producer job at FAN, one which I was offered and was ready to accept until ESPN Radio offered me an opportunity that same evening. The Bristol job was one I could not turn down, even though I grew up loving The Fan and wanting to work there. I had a chance to visit with Chris and discuss his radio growth in New York, the challenging situations he's faced during his career, the Craig Carton saga, moving into TV, and of course his current role in Philadelphia. And I think you guys are going to enjoy some of the stories I had to share. So without further delay, here's my conversation with Chris Carlin. 3, 2, 1. New Jersey native, early 40s. 2 decades in New York, now in Philly. But before you landed where you are, Chris, there had to be a bunch of twists and turns. There usually is for everybody who gets in the business. When did your interest in this format originally begin?
Just in terms of getting into broadcasting, I thought I was going to college to go to law school, and that was over pretty quick as soon as I took a poli-sci class. it really wasn't long. But, you know, I got involved in a college radio station there purely by accident. It was at Hobart College in Geneva, New York. The color commentator had gotten in an altercation at a bar downtown. He was a former football player. He had been pretty drunk, and he turned around. Somebody pulled a prank on him and pulled his pants down. He turns around, and he punches the first person he sees, and it's an off-duty cop. So needless to say, he was asked to not return to the broadcast. And so they needed somebody in a pinch, and I had played a little bit in, like, junior high, but the guy who I knew asked me, who was involved at the station, if I was interested in giving it a shot. And I thought, what the hell? And I just fell in love with it immediately and thought that I was going to be like the next Marv Albert because we're doing games. But being from Jersey, I had also had summer jobs in high school and college where I was delivering for a drugstore. and I would drive around and I was listening to Mike and the Mad Dog every day. Mm-hmm. I loved WFAN and wanted to just do anything I could to try to work there. And I didn't have a job when I got out of college. I sent out 100 resumes. I literally 100 did not get one interview. And I tried to get an internship at FAN. And that's where it all started for me there. I was just thrilled to be there in the first place.
So essentially, while you're applying with these 100 resumes, nobody wound up pantsless and drunk. So unfortunately, you didn't get a call. But as you mentioned, they finally give you a shot to get inside the building at the FAN. How did that process begin and what did they initially have you doing?
You know, I was interning for the first 3 months. It was the fall of 1995. And I, you know, was editing tape and answering phones and all that kind of stuff. And I was just very much of the mindset of, I was starstruck to begin with to be around the place, having listened to it for so long. But I was never a guy that wanted to go up to people and chat them up or anything like that. I just kind of kept my head down and did whatever they told me to do. And so at the end of the 3 months, again, I didn't have a job, and I just went to Eric Spitz, and I just kind of meekly said, you know, I don't know what I would have to do or what I could do for you, but I just would do anything to work here. And he gave me some part-time work, you know, on the holidays and overnights and stuff like that. I did every shift that nobody wanted to do, and that's how it started. And, you know, whenever they would call, was if somebody would call out sick for an overnight or something like that, I'd always say yes, whether I had plans or not, and I'm going to do whatever it takes to be here and to stay here. And, you know, eventually that worked out.
It's amazing how much, you know, some of the things that as this business has changed in 20 years, 30 years, there are still some things that don't. And that's hard work, being flexible, dedicated, and showing that you have a passion for something. And so showing those guys that you're willing to come in on the holiday, willing to work the graveyard shift or work the Saturday and Sunday when everyone wants to be out goes a long way. And obviously, you were doing some things right while you were there during those hours because they eventually give you a call and say, hey, how about stepping up to produce and join Mike and the Mad Dog? Now, this is the show you've listened to that inspired you to want to get in the building. And you mentioned how you kind of flew under the radar and didn't try to, you know, stick your neck out there, so to speak. But now you're going on to the money show for these guys. How intimidating was that for you?
Incredibly. Jason, I had been working at FAN and I've been working on the air doing morning sports at the tiny station in Rockland, WRKL.
Mm-hmm.
And Eric Spitz called me, and first it was the assistant producer. It was to run the board,
right.
And that was in March of 97. And those guys didn't know me at all. You know, I had been working the night shifts and all those other kind of things. So, you know, I did that for a few months. I got comfortable, and then Bob Gelb, one day that summer, closed the door to the control room and said, I'm leaving the show. I want you to be the guy to produce the show. And I was 24, and I was just, what? I saw the pressure that he was under every day, and I never considered it. I had never thought about it, but I said, yeah. I mean, he didn't offer it to me, but I, you know, Mike and Chris then talked to me, and Mark Chernoff offered me the job, and it was mind-blowing and beyond overwhelming because I had no idea what I was doing. I had absolutely no idea what I was doing, and it was an absolute trial by fire. Really, for the first year or so, it was very intimidating.
That seems to be the business in general a lot, right? I mean, you talked about hosting at WRKL. Nobody's coming in there and telling you, Chris, here's how you format a show, why you should go with topic A versus topic B. You just kind of do it. And, you know, sometimes you land in sunshine, sometimes you land in the sewer. But it really comes down to trying to make those guys feel that they have a competent guy behind them. But at the same time, there's no playbook for producing a show. I'm curious. I mean, look, at this time, the show is dominant in the ratings. You know these yep. guys are passionate, knowledgeable. Their chemistry is great. But there has to be some type of method to the madness. So what exactly, when to the guy listening to this who's in the business, who's going, what made Mike and Chris work? What went into producing that show?
As you said, they were clicking on all cylinders at that point,
mm-hmm.
and I felt like the only thing I could do is screw it up. But even I couldn't do that. They were too powerful of a force.
Right.
This is really middle of the heyday. We sit here and we talk about prep every day, and we talk about all that kind of stuff, and those guys knew everything that was going on. There was never a question about, you know, did he watch this game or did he know what happened in this game or anything like that. They always did. So from that standpoint, I kind of had it easy. There wasn't much I had to do in terms of helping them prepare. My job was primarily to get the guests on. And I specifically remember, you know, during the World Series 1997, Jim Leland had gone on the other station, which was at that time was One-on-One Sports. They had an outlet in New York. And my boss came to me and said, I expect Mike Hargrove to be on tomorrow. And I'm like, how the hell am I going to get Mike Hargrove on? And no joke, at the time, I called easily 50 hotels in Miami and finally found him. And he said, yeah, you know, just give me a call tomorrow. I'm thinking, great, he's going to blow me off here. But he, to his credit, he showed up the next day. But he knew what the show was. He knew them.
Right.
So that helped. But you know, as far as what made them work, it's impossible to just describe that. The way that they played off one another, I mean, I just think down to the very sound of their voices.
Yeah.
It just was an indescribable combination. Man, I wish I was smart enough to understand it. I guess one thing that I have always said about them is that people looked at that show and listened and thought, well, Mike's the smart one and Chris is the nutty, passionate one. Well, people always underestimated Mike's passion, and people always underestimated Chris's knowledge.
Yep.
Chris was a freaking encyclopedia on past and things going on. And Mike, when he got fired up about something, get out of the way. You know, I think that got buried sometimes because of Chris's wacky voice and stuff like that. I always felt like that was the case with the two of them.
Their combination was incredible. I mean, everything you just touched on was right on point. I mean, the reason I'm doing this today is because of that show, and a lot of people in our business are in it because of what those guys did on the air. When did the nickname Continent come up? How did that get bestowed upon you?
That was Mike. If you'll remember, it was late 90s. Bryant Reeves was playing for Oklahoma State, Big Country.
Right, right.
And it was during the tournament, and the next year at the tournament, we always ordered pizza the first day of the tournament at noon, and St. Mary's in California was playing, and they had a guy who was 7'4", and like 330, and his nickname was Big Continent, and Mike just started calling me Continent, and that's where it came from, but it wasn't the greatest nickname in the world, but, you know, and with Chris, it turns into other things. It's, hello, Connie, how are you? And it's just, it can turn into 10 different versions of the nickname, but that's where it came from.
That's when you know you're accepted. Take me through this, because it was well documented on the 30 for 30 that at times in that relationship, it was very fractured. How did you, as the guy who's their producer, balance that? How do you go to work with two guys not talking?
It was not easy. You know, it started with Knicks Pacers in Indiana. I believe it was game 5. We were supposed to go back out there. We had been there for 1 and 2, and Mike just clearly didn't want to go.
Right.
And we got to the airport at LaGuardia that morning, and the flight was canceled, and the only way we could get there was through Washington, and it didn't have first class, so Mike just said, I'm not going, we're not going. And Chris got ticked off. And the next day, Jeff Van Gundy in the game made what Chris thought was a bad coaching decision, and Chris went off, and Mike was very close to Jeff. And that really is where the fire got lit the day before, but the gasoline was poured on the next day.
Right.
As far as how I'm trying to handle it at that point, you wanted each guy to believe that you were their guy. Chris, it was easier with because he dealt with it a little bit better. Mike just wanted you to be his guy, and that was it. You know, he'd go off on the entire situation, and I'll never forget being outside of Mark Chernoff's office, and Mike screaming that I'm never working with him again, and Chris said something like, I just signed a new contract, don't let the door hit you in the ass. So that whole summer, they were just not talking at all. They hadn't been talking doing the show. It was a little over-exaggerated. It wasn't 6 months. It was probably 2.5, 3 months that they weren't talking doing the show.
Right.
But nobody ever knew listening. To their credit, it didn't hurt the show, but it definitely was, it was a bad, bad time in the show. And it was the only time that I, in the middle of it, thought that it was over. And, it was well documented. Mike's fiance then invited Chris to the wedding without telling Mike. And Chris came, and we were all at the wedding, and they just started chatting, and that's how it started to get back together.
When you reflect back on that time, what are the memories you're most proud and happy about?
I was with the show for about 7 years, and I produced it for 6.5. Just the times when you're able to deliver for them in the crunch were the best times.
Mm-hmm.
Wally Cerbiak, after a 40-plus point game in the tournament, I don't even remember where it was, but somehow was able to get him on before the end of the show. And this was not the time of cell phones or any of that kind of thing. My favorite moment of all time was Alex Rodriguez when he had signed in Texas. And he had watched Mike and Chris. He knew them, but they had never had him on. And the Yankees were playing the Rangers in spring training. And so we were down there. I went to – and A-Rod made the trip up to Tampa. So I went down to the locker room, middle of the game, and he was there by himself. It would never be like this now. You know, he was talking to one reporter. And I went up and introduced myself, and I thought maybe I could just get him to the phone here in the locker room. And he's like, well, no, are they here? And I said, yeah. He said, well, I'll come see him. And he said, come back in, 40 minutes and we'll do it. And I'm thinking, again, you're thinking he's blowing me off.
Right.
And at 5 o'clock, I went and got him, and he said, yeah, let's go. And he walks up. And what was funny about that was the Yankees were not easy to deal with. They would only do it on the phone from the locker room. We're literally not 100 yards away upstairs. We could have a wireless headset and do it from the dugout. They wouldn't do it. They did it from the phone in the locker room. So I walked past the Yankees PR director, Rick Cerrone, with Alex next to me. Like, at the time, he wasn't even married yet. He borrowed my phone to call his girlfriend. it was just beyond bizarre. I mean, at this point, he is the biggest star in the world next to Tiger Woods.
Right.
And so I'm walking up. I walk past Rick Cerrone, and I poke my head in the, in the booth. And Mike says, we'll replay Joe Torre for you next. And 5 o'clock was the big time. Everybody's getting in their car. And I poked my head in, and I just said in a very wise-ass way to Mike, replaying Joe Torre. And he starts cursing, what the hell do you think you're doing? And I open the door a little wider. I said, Mike, you know Alex Rodriguez. And he walks in, and his jaw just dropped and hit the floor. And Chris, the same thing. And as soon as Alex, he gave him 20 great minutes and just could not have been better. And it was amazing. So, that was my most proud moment as a producer.
So then at that point, it becomes like if you ever go to the well to tell Mike he's not doing something again, you better deliver the equivalent of another A-Rod or you're totally screwed.
Let's put it this way. It was the only time I told Mike he wasn't doing something, and I never told him it again.
Right.
You better have somebody like A-Rod backing you up at that point.
All right, so while you were on the show, and correct me if I'm wrong here, because I'm going off of memory, you were faced with one of your real first professional challenges because a Kansas City radio station was interested in hiring you. Am I correct so far?
You are. Yeah, they were starting up 610 Sports. Yeah.
Right. So I remember because Mike and Chris would talk about this on the air and they're like, he's going to go, Mikey. And they do the whole thing about whether or not you were going to stay. How did that develop and why did you ultimately choose not to go there?
Yeah, I got contacted through Andy Roth, the PD who's in Cleveland now.
Right.
He had a friend who was a consultant, and they were starting this station. And I went out to visit with them. I had done some shows here and there, but not anything consistently. And I had gone to the Super Bowl. This was early 2002. And I had reported for IMUS that week. And so I went out and visited with them. And I just thought it was an interview. And it was very much like they were giving me the job, and I just kind of said that at one point, and they said, yeah. I got the offer, and, at first it was like, okay, it is what it is financially. You're going to Kansas City. You understand that. But I just didn't have the right vibe. I'll be honest with you. One issue was that Jason Whitlock had really been the guy that had been behind this station and had gone over there to Entercom and had said, hey, let's start this. Let's take them on. He had left angrily. And he wasn't quite the polarizing figure that he is now, mm-hmm. then, but it just didn't quite feel right. Like, could this fall apart pretty quickly if he comes over here and he gets mad at that management? So that was something that had me concerned.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing was that I just didn't love the instincts. And I'll give you an example, and this is going to sound stupid, but it just is what it is. And they took me out to lunch and dinner on the trip, right? We're in Kansas City. They took me out to Italian. I'm from New Jersey. I'm from New Jersey.
Right.
They took me out to Italian for lunch and seafood for dinner. We're in Kansas City.
Right. You're going, where's the barbecue, guys?
Show me on the town. And that was, it was just a little thing, but it's like, yeah, maybe the ends here aren't great. I just didn't feel right about it at the end. I just didn't. So I've always been a gut feeling guy, and part of it was money, part of it was that, but mostly it was gut feeling.
When you start your career, you're just excited to have a job, and then as you go, you start to become more astute of the business and whether or not things are right and what the trajectory is for you. You know, can I be here for 10 years? Am I only going to be here for a year? And ultimately, you got to make calls, and sometimes you'll be right, sometimes wrong, but you got to trust your gut. And you brought up Imus during that spiel there about the Kansas City situation. And although you didn't go to KC, you wind up starting to get a little more run on the fan. Before you know it, they're moving you into overnights. But that doesn't last long because Sid Rosenberg departs Imus's show, had some challenges to deal with. You now get moved into the morning show, which is completely different. As intense as Mike and Chris are, and probably are, you know, difficult to manage, this is a whole different ballgame because Imus doesn't do a sports show. It's a very different type of vibe. And I asked you before about how intimidated you were going into produce Mike and the Mad Dog. This, I'm sure, has to be equally as intimidating, if not more, right?
Oh, no question. You know, I had filled in for a month when Sid initially got into some trouble and went to rehab.
Yep.
And it went really well because I have always been more of a off-the-top-of-my-head kind of guy, just being a little quicker. But I'm not a prepared comedy kind of guy. You know, Mike Breen had been unbelievably brilliant on that show.
Mm-hmm.
And his was all very prepared, and but he was just so funny.
Yeah.
He had an unbelievable sense of humor, and that was a lot to live up to. He had left a couple of years earlier. So, and Sid was more of just kind of sit in there and comment on everything. So they had me during that month just kind of hang out, and it went really well. And it was because, like, I just kind of was there and commenting a little bit things here and there and doing the sports updates. And then when they moved me in there full-time, and mind you, in silly fashion, Jason, this was not a slam dunk for me because it wasn't what I wanted to do. You know, I had just gotten that overnight show, and I'm thinking this is my first big, huge break, but I'm not thinking clearly, like, this is Imus, and you're going to be getting ridiculous exposure. So I didn't really have a choice, but I did it. I did, but I didn't have a choice. I could have said to Mark, I don't want to do it, but how is that good for your career?
Right.
So then it just became more challenging because my role changed there. It wasn't like the first time around where I just kind of sat in and talked about anything. It was just more prepared, funny stuff. I'm not a comedy writer by any stretch. It was a bad fit for me.
You know, look, I was a big fan of what you were doing on The Fan. I knew what Imus did, and I you know, obviously he was great at it. But a lot of this is just like the old adage in boxing, styles make fights, and it felt like a weird combo. And I remember there were times he would take some jabs at you. And there's a difference between natural ball busting, being funny, and where you feel like it's personal and uncomfortable. And I would listen to them go at you, and I'm going, God, guys, this isn't fun. This feels a little like dark and like there's some bitterness in the room. And, you know, look, if you're one of Don's guys, you're going to be okay. But I could only imagine being in your shoes at that point, how mentally challenging that had to be.
It was. Every morning, you know, I'd be getting up at 4, and I'm not going to lie, I was dreading it. I got to try to come up with some things to be funny today, and, you know, sometimes you hit, and it was a great feeling when you hit, but most of the time I didn't. I just, hey, it wasn't my thing. I wasn't good at it,
mm-hmm.
And I was doing everything I could to try to be good at it, and you're right, there were times where it was getting personal. I just think Bernard was so bummed out that Sid was gone because Sid was his kind of guy.
Right.
So he went after me personally all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And then off the air would be, you know, as sweet as could be. At least with Imus, you know, on and off the air, he was the same. But Listen, I'm not going to deny that the exposure was incredible for me. You're on TV every morning.
Yep.
But at the same time, I never felt comfortable doing it. There were a couple times where I thought Sid was coming back. Like, it was openly talked about, not just on the air, but off. Like, we're going to take you off this. And for whatever reason, it just didn't happen. And I would have been okay with it. You know, I got married in January of 2007, and I vividly remember my wife in February and March. I'd be getting up at 4, and she would just kind of rub my back and say, it'll be 10 o'clock before you know it.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was the most challenging time of my career, no question.
And while you're in this role, now obviously you learn a whole different side of the business because at this time, you're involved with Rutgers too. You know, started as sideline guy, became the school's voice, and now all of a sudden you happen to be off when the Imus blow-up happens where he goes off on the women's basketball players. But obviously, you're the sports anchor of that show, working for Rutgers. One of the biggest national personalities in the land is killing them and is now under fire. What was that like for you?
On Monday, I was feeling just awful at the end of the show, and I went home and I just had the worst flu ever. You know, it sapped everything. I couldn't move, and I was just the worst kind of sick. And so that's why I was out the next day. I was actually out the rest of the week. Like Wednesday, I got an email from somebody at Rutgers asking, hey, do you know anything about this? And I said, geez, no, I wasn't there. It really hadn't blown up yet. And I said, I wasn't there, but I'll see what I can find out. And, you know, as it continued to just kind of roll on that week, it picked up steam. And at first, Imus didn't really want to apologize. His first reaction was, you know, lighten up. But after that, I was out of line and this was really wrong and all that kind of thing. It was incredibly uncomfortable. And I went back to work on Monday, but, you know, Sunday night, I didn't want to go back. And I looked at Cheryl, my wife, and I said, I don't think I should. And she said, okay, then don't. And so I called Mark, and, you know, Mark's obviously had a very stressful week and it's not ending anytime soon. And I said, Mark, I'm not coming in tomorrow. I don't want to support this guy because I did think that he had a degree of racism to him, to be honest. And Mark said, well, I'll call him. And, you know, Mark was understanding about it, but he said, you basically could be telling me here you're quitting. And I said, I'm not quitting, but let's worry about that later. And in the midst of it, Rutgers happened to call me. Bob Mulcahy from Rutgers called me, who was the athletic director. And he had kind of gotten the wind of the fact that I was a little bit stressed out about the whole situation. And he called me, and I told him what was going on, and he said, go to work. We know this wasn't you. We know you had nothing to do with it. And it just put me at ease. So I went back to work the next morning. I think Mark was appreciative of it. And I wasn't trying to make any big political stand. I didn't want to be part of supporting him for the moment. I just didn't feel right about it. And Imus, to his credit, apologized to me as well off the air about the situation that I had been put in. And it continued to pick up steam. If you remember, you're just sitting there, you know, first he got suspended by NBC, then by CBS, and there was nothing going on in the news cycle.
Right.
Nothing at all. And again, it happened. He gets fired by NBC and CBS fires him on Thursday in the middle of his radiothon.
Yeah.
Which was, it was as strange as could be. And Friday morning, his wife hosted the show for him because it was the radiothon. They let her do it with Charles McCord. And he actually came to the station that day, and he called me back to the office and was very contrite about the situation. I give him credit for that. You know, he had had the meeting with the women's team the night before, and he fully understood what he had done wrong.
Now, being a on-air personality yourself, and you realize quickly how powerful your words can be, and whether your intent is one way or another, whether you were just doing it busting balls. I mean, you say the wrong thing at the wrong time, you lose clients, you lose relationships, and next thing you know, you lose the job. And that puts the station at this point in a bad spot. You know, they've got to find a morning show. They do that. They go through the process, and it ultimately lands on Boomer and Carton. Despite Mark's initial hesitancy with you about, hey, you may be quitting, he stands by you because you ultimately become the anchor of Boomer and Carton when they're starting out. How would you describe going through that transition period? And then, you know, you were on Boomer and Carton for what, about a year and a half?
Yep. Those guys didn't sign up for me, and I didn't sign up for them. And I didn't understand Craig at the beginning. And really, the time I was there, and I thought, oh, this is just another guy that's going to say something stupid, and you knew what the reputation was, and get himself in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Boomer was into it, and I did not know if it was going to work or not, but, you know, Craig clearly knew what he was doing with radio. There was no question about that. But it wasn't my kind of thing. So for the year and a half that I was there, I just tried to do whatever I could to fit in. Most of that was me, you know, not him. He's coming in, and he's just trying to be successful because he's just gotten a major opportunity. And at the time, I was probably just too caught up in all the drama of the months before and what's going to happen here and all that. And so I was with him for a year and a half, and they were good to me. It wasn't the best fit at the time. And, you know, I was making a decent amount of money, and I didn't think it was pretty clear the station was not going to pay me the same kind of money to stay and just be an anchor. And Mark also, to his credit, gave me an hour show every morning from 5 to 6 leading into it,
right?
Which I love doing. And some days I did it with Kimberly Jones, and some days I did it alone. But, you know, Mark always believed in me and always wanted to find more ways to get me on the air. Like, he thought I had a good temperament to kind of be in there with him. And we did some things that were good. But again, it wasn't me at my best.
Mm-hmm.
It really wasn't. I should have done a better job. Like, if you listen to Jerry Recco, he's perfect.
Yeah.
He's absolutely perfect. He does a fantastic job. Like, I should have tried to do that more than what I was doing, which was going in and out, but not really trying to, you're not being a comedy writer, but you're using the sound bites better, all that kind of stuff.
Right.
Jerry is masterful at it.
You mentioned that you early on weren't a big Craig guy, even though you respected what he was trying to do. I mean, when you heard the news about what went down with Craig this past week, what was your reaction to it?
I was very surprised. You know, Craig is not a dumb guy. Craig's a smart guy, and I completely understood better being away from the show what he was doing in hosting that show, and he had obviously done a lot of good through that show with charity stuff, with the game that they put together at Yankee Stadium a few years ago that got 17,000 people. I just felt bad in the whole situation. You know, I don't know how to feel for him. You want to hope that it's all not true. I feel the worst for his family right now,
right,
and what they have to deal with. His wife and his four kids, they're good people. They are. I can't really comment on what he did because I have no idea. You know, it's just one of those things where you just hope for the best out of the situation, and you hope he comes out of the other side of whatever it ends up being better off for it. But yeah, I was very surprised. I mean, stunned is more of the word that I would use.
So you spent over a decade at The Fan. You've been on the air and off the air there. You've been around Mark Chernoff when big situations have come up, and there's very few who are on that level of when you have something like Don Imus got replaced by Boomer and Carton, and they went up in ratings and revenue. I mean, Mark Chernoff does as good of a job as you can in these situations, although I'm sure he'd prefer never to have to deal with them. What do you do if you're Mark Chernoff right now?
Mark has been an outside-the-box thinker. Nobody even had a clue about Craig Carton at the time,
right?
As a possibility. And Mark is smart at always, he doesn't let people know what he's thinking. He lets the people that he needs to let know what he's thinking. Listen, you got hit by an atomic bomb. There's not an easy solution there. So you got to just find somebody that's going to fit. To me, when I say outside the box, I don't think there's a natural guy to step in there and do the job. It's not easy.
Mm-hmm.
Bob Raisman, an interesting name that came up today in Michael Rapaport. He's that kind of guy. I could see that being something that you would look at and try it out. Hey, maybe this will work, something like that. I don't think that you can go that traditional radio route necessarily. What is clear is you do need somebody that drives the show, and that's what Craig did exceptionally well. Drives the show, gets the best out of Boomer, and Boomer at the same time is on board with everything you're doing. And I give Boomer a lot of credit because a lot of ex-athletes are just worried about themselves and they don't want to be made fun of or anything like that, and they don't want to be made to look bad. And Boomer didn't want to be made to look bad, but he made that clear to Craig at the beginning. But he also let him know, hey, you're okay to mess around with me on the air. Let's do that. So I think a lot of that is going to be somebody understanding how smart Boomer is at it and trying to drive that show. Can a guy like Rappaport drive a radio show? I don't know that yet. But I do think you have to think about somebody that's not in the obvious names.
Well, you took a not obvious route after The Fan because you made the jump into TV, which I'm sure I've read some quotes from you that you were not thinking television star was in your future. But you became part of that with SNY. You started to contribute with Loudmouths with Adam Schein. You also got into some Mets pre and post stuff and Beer Money and a few other things. Take me through, as a lifelong radio guy at that point, what the toughest adjustments were to going into TV and how you overcame them.
For me, it was easy. The toughest adjustment was, and I don't mean the transition was easy, but what it was is trusting a lot of other people to get it done. Because in radio, it's you and the microphone, ultimately, right?
Right.
And your producer, but it's you and the microphone. In TV, there's 15 other people, 20 other people on the show, video, sound, all these kinds of different things that make it go. And you find yourself at first thinking about all those things and thinking about all those people. You can't control them. You can only control what you're doing up there. It was that. It was having somebody talk in your ear consistently at the same time while you're talking. Took me a while on that one. And then trusting all those people. It just took a little bit of time to understand that they know what they're doing. I never remotely considered TV because I would not be described as your prototypical television anchor in terms of my looks. But to Kurt Gowdy and Fred Wilpon's credit, at least for me, that's what they liked. Like, Fred Wilpon liked having the everyman on the air. And if there's anything I am, it's an everyman, there's no doubt. So that's kind of how that worked. And with Loudmouths, it was so much easier having Adam there. Adam was a locomotive every day of energy and ideas, and we had great debates. We knew each other a little bit. And, I mean, back to your point about guys that work hard and try to get their opportunity, Adam grew up in Rockland County, and I barely knew him. I asked him, he was still in college, I asked him to fill in doing morning sports on New Year's Day morning. He came and did it, just the updates, and he did it. What college kid wants to do that on New Year's morning, you know?
Right.
But that, you know, that's where you know. Anyway.
So all of these experiences add up when you finally get to where you want to be. And right now you've landed that big break. You're doing afternoons in Philadelphia, WIP. Lifelong New York guy, born in New Jersey, now talking sports in Philadelphia. How did the situation with Spike and everybody in CBS Philadelphia materialize from the start?
When my contract was up at SNY for full-time, I told them that I wanted to scale back and just be part-time so I could do some radio stuff. I had been itching to get back to radio.
Mm-hmm.
I really had. So, and you know, you put yourself in that position, whether it's going to be full-time at Sirius or somewhere else, I just wanted to be available if it came up. At FAN, we always knew what WIP was. You know, you always knew the powerful impact that it had in Philadelphia. And there were only a couple of places that I would have left Sirius and SNY and New York for, and this was easily one of them. So it came up when Josh got fired, and I kind of jokingly reached out to Mark Chernoff, since they're both CBS Radio, and said, you know, I'd been filling in, doing a couple of shows, and we had been talking about something, and I said, well, we can talk about it tomorrow unless you want to talk about Philly today. And I was kind of half-joking, and he wrote back, and he said, I think they're going to go with a local guy. I'm like, all right. And then the next week, he said, Spike Eskin's going to call you. Said, okay. So we chatted on the phone, and it was Labor Day weekend, so almost a little more than a year ago. And I came back from Seattle. I was with Rutgers for the opener in Washington, and Spike and I had agreed that Sunday to meet at a diner in New Jersey. And, Jason, we had a three-hour brunch last lunch, and it was amazing. I was blown away by this guy. He just was so sharp, and we shared a lot of the same ideals about what we thought was going to make a good show. And I left there thinking, if they offer me this thing, I'm running there. Because, I mean, you know how it is. The relationship between talent and management, you got to believe in one another. And management believes in talent, but a lot of times you got to go the other way. And that's what it was for me right away with this guy. And Spike walks in, and you know, like, Spike's got tats up and down his arms. He does not look like a sports radio PD.
Right, right.
And you're thinking, like, what's this guy? But then you just figure out how smart he is pretty quickly. And I left that meeting just being ultra excited about it. And then he got Ike Reese and me together, and we had a great dinner and a very honest conversation about things. And that's where it all came from there. And Spike was rolling the dice in a big way on me, because he's bringing in a guy from New York who has not worked in another market his entire life, and that's a town that they cannot stand in Philadelphia.
Well, you're going right where I was going to go, because, look, it helped on day one when Angelo Cataldi gives you guys the blessing. There's no doubt that that's important. But that being said, Philadelphia fans, I spent time there. I know they'll chew you up and spit you out if they sense that you're looking in the rearview mirror or using them as a stepping stone. You've got to have a certain, you know, thick skin about you to be able to handle, especially the beginning. But you also have to work hard to gain their trust. So take me through entering the market, how you've been able to do that. What was your approach going in?
You know, Angelo, first of all, was amazing during the process, too. Gave us the blessing day one, had us on that first morning.
Yep.
But even still, I had talked to him a couple of times leading up to whether or not I was going to get the job. And when they offered it to me, and he was just great. Because Angelo was in that same spot 30 years ago.
Right.
Where he was from somewhere else and gave me 45 minutes. Phenomenal. You don't know. Like, our first show was at Chickies and Pete's. It was after the first Giants-Eagles game last year. And I had gone to the game, and I just started talking about the game and all this. And for the first 2 months, there was a lot of, you're from New York, what do you know? And I totally get that, and I totally respect it. Because if you're a Philly guy, they love you. You're Philly town. But at the same time, you're talking about what they care about. They come around on you, and they have come around on me. They've been phenomenal. They've just been great. Like, I don't hear that anymore. I haven't heard it in months about, oh, you're not from here. What the hell do you know? I really have tried to just ingratiate myself into the city as much as I could, and we've done some different things to try to get to know people too, whether it's, you know, I went to somebody's house for the draft and just kind of showed up and hung out with about 15 guys watching the draft, and went to a bunch of baseball games and with listeners, and just had like 10, 12 listeners come out to the game and just BS for 9 innings. It's just a city I'm still learning about every day, and I absolutely love it, but they make you earn it. People have this idea, you know, maybe at WIP you just show up and they'll just talk about the Eagles. No, you got to hook them in every day. You got to give them a reason to be engaged in your show. It's taught me so much. I don't think I've learned more about being a talk show host in my entire 15 years leading up to the last year or two than I have in the last year and a half or so just doing it at other places.
So one of those differences is that now you host on a daily basis with a guy who's played the game in Ike Reese. I mean, you had some of those experiences on a lesser scale at SiriusXM, but when you're doing it day after day, 4 hours a day, 5 days a week, there are benefits and challenges of working with an athlete. So having been the everyman, the guy who sees the game through the fans' eyes, what are the pros and cons, if you will, of working with an athlete, and how do you approach that?
Ike is an incredible guy from an energy standpoint and from an understanding radio standpoint. He knows the audience and every day understands what's going to connect with them, and that has helped me immensely.
Mm-hmm.
Listen, we both know how this is. There are athletes who just show up and just do it, and they're getting a check, and they're not trying all that hard. Ike watches everything, whether it's the Sixers, he's on top of it. And he certainly knows the Eagles inside and out. You know, it's never that kind of question of like, oh, he's limited. He can only talk about this. He can talk about anything.
Right.
The benefit for me is, I think the mentality for him is He's a fifth-round pick, a guy that had to earn it, a special teams guy, and he carries that mentality through life, and he treats his job like that every day, and that is everything for us. Because if you don't have someone there that is fully engaged and not just giving an opinion or two on sports and then, you know, thinking about something else, you're dead. And he could not have been a better fit. I'll let you know when there's a con, because I haven't found it yet. And I'm not just saying that because he's my partner. Now, he's not. No, I mean, like, the big pro for me is that he's a former athlete that, yeah, he has an ego, but he doesn't have an ego to the point where he can just show up and make the magic happen. He works at it. The best thing I can say about Ike, as I told you about our first meeting, is that he wasn't afraid to ask me direct questions right away, and I did the same to him. First thing out of the gate, he's like, you're doing all this Rutgers stuff. How engaged are you going to be doing this every day? And I looked back at him and I said, okay, well, I'm doing football and basketball. I said, I'm giving up basketball to do this. This is what I want to do. And football, I will never miss a show during an important ratings book because of football. Like, there was some question on his part, like, I was doing TV here, I'm doing this there. And I had always been that guy that was kind of jumping around doing a lot of different things. But does he just want to come and do this? Because there are a lot of guys who think that if they're in TV, oh, I could just go and do radio. No, you can't. The TV is infinitely easier than radio, and they don't understand that. So I think that you rarely have people with the mentality in TV who say, I can't wait to get back and do radio and do that full time and not do anything else. And I was saying it to him, but I think he believed me at the time, but there was probably some skepticism, and I showed him that that's truly what I was engaged in. This is it. Like, this is it to me.
Now, you mentioned ratings, and you were around Mike and Chris, and you know how obsessed they were over having top performance. You're in a competitive market. You're going against a guy in Mike Missanelli who started, you know, had a big impact with WIP for a long time. And obviously, you don't go into any new show and it all of a sudden, hey, we're here, and the audience immediately changes. It's about progress. So when you guys are analyzing your performance and where you guys were versus where you are now, how do you guys determine whether or not you're on the track that you want to be on?
Just when it's trending upward. And, you know, it's so funny. You can look at the ratings now hour by hour, and you could never do it back then.
Right.
With PPM, and you can say, all right, this works, this doesn't. And it gives you a chance to analyze a little bit more where you could really do your best work and engage with the audience at its best. I think that's how we measure it, but I also don't get too caught up in it. Mm-hmm. You want to analyze it a bit, but you can't let it dictate everything about what you're doing, because you have to be yourself in the show or you're dead, because they sniff out fake any second. They absolutely do. I am glad of one thing. In moving back from TV to radio, a big part of why I wanted to do it is I needed a scoreboard. I needed a competitiveness to it. A lot of times in TV, especially in local cable, they're getting your money. The scoreboard is the, you know, they're getting the money from cable subscribers, and that's 90% of their revenue. They're only making money in radio one way, and that's, you know, NTR and advertising.
Right.
So it's a very simple scoreboard. If you get the ratings, they'll be able to sell, and that's when you're successful. And I wanted that challenge and that pressure. I wanted that true feeling of competition.
Listening to you talk about Philly, I mean, and your opportunity there, you seem really energized and excited by it. Is this a place you could see yourself spending the rest of your career?
I wouldn't have taken the job if I didn't plan on doing that. I really wouldn't have. I'm in Philly because the energy of the market is remarkable. The fans are as good as it gets, and this is a great opportunity. This is a great station. I want that to be the place where I finished my career. I wouldn't have taken the job otherwise. I said it to Spike. We kind of looked at each other, and I said, hopefully we're here for 20 years doing this. And the same thing with Ike. And I can't describe what it's made me feel like professionally over the last 9-10 months now. It's been reinvigorating for me, and I just needed the challenge in the worst way. But it's a challenge every day because they do make you earn it, and I love that about the town.
You've been in New York and Philadelphia. Phone calls are a big part of sports radio in each of those markets. What's your philosophy on the importance of calls to a talk show?
my philosophy is this. You have to be prepared that you're not going to get one call, but I know everybody says that. To me, it's about engaging. That's where it's important. It is just a little signal that you have said something that is engaged with the audience a little bit.
Right.
You know, if you're trying to make a point or you start the show with something that doesn't have something compelling, they're not going to call. And sometimes even when you feel like you have something compelling, they're still making you earn it and they're not jumping out. You have to find a way to engage with them, and that is the easiest way to tell if you have said something that has engaged the audience, that has caught their attention.
Some talk show hosts love interviews. Others can't stand them. I'm sure if Carson Wentz shows up at the door with your producer, given that you just joined the Wentz wagon, that'll probably get you a little perked up. But where do you stand on having players, coaches, executives on the air, and what's your philosophy when it comes to day-to-day interviews on a show and how long they should be and what you're looking for out of them?
I don't want to do 25 minutes with somebody that's not bringing something to the table, put it that way. In my estimation, I've changed about this over the years. Most interviews shouldn't go more than 8 or 9 minutes at the most.
Mm-hmm.
But if it's somebody that's giving you something, you leave that open a little bit. I don't hate interviews, but I'm not just putting on a writer just to put on a writer.
Right.
I got to get something. With the Eagles, obviously, that's what everybody cares about first and foremost. If you're getting something out of what happened at practice that day and you have a writer that understands, as far as the athletes, if they're just 10-word guys, we don't need it. Doesn't matter what the name is. You're going to have Carson Wentz on the show. He speaks well. He's a good interview, but he doesn't say a whole lot.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to have Howie Roseman on the show. He doesn't say a whole lot. What I kind of have fun with is trying to get him to say something. That's where it becomes at least entertaining for me.
So you've had the benefit of working for Mark Chernoff and Eric Spitz, two highly respected programmers in our business. What would you say each of them do best, and what's one area they could each improve at?
You know, Mark listens and understands everything about the show, and he is as honest as can be. That is always what has been best. The two of them are as honest as can be. They're going to tell you stink. And Mark told me at the beginning of my career, I stunk. Like, he gave me chances to do some shows, and I just wasn't very good, and he was honest about it. And I would not have gotten better if you don't tell me that. The honesty is important.
Right.
Some people don't want to hear it. No, it's the only way you get better. I just think Mark's instincts when it comes to programming, I consistently go back to that IMA situation and how he was able to put two guys together that didn't know each other or complete polar opposites and make that work, and just being able to see that it was going to work somehow was remarkable. You know, with Mark and Eric, as far as what they can do better, there's not a whole lot. I mean, I just feel like they both are very smart when it comes to this and very understanding of the importance of having your talent in the right frame of mind. But at the same time, assigning responsibility for the shows equally on people, on producers. It's an accountability thing that they do have, and I needed that in my career. And the other thing, too, is you can have an honest conversation back with them, and it might even turn into, you know, getting a little bit heated, but it's forgotten in 2 minutes.
Right.
You know, it's not something that's ever going to linger with them. Because they understand we all have the same thing in mind, and that's what's best for the radio station.
It's like a sports locker room. You got to be able to just speak your mind at times, move on. The next day is a new challenge. You know, it's like you can't live in the last at bat or the last play, and there's too much to do. Let me hit you with the same question. How is the relationship and the day-to-day interaction with Spike a little different?
I think it's different because Spike, he's a little more laid back in terms of how he delivers a message.
Mm-hmm.
He'll come in and say, hey, this, you need to maybe do this differently or maybe think about this, and you could agree or disagree, and he'll say, okay, it's your show, and you're the one responsible for the numbers.
Right.
So it makes you listen. And the other thing, too, is, and this always carries weight with me, if you're not on top of somebody every day, when you do have something to say, they're going to listen more. Spike has called us on a couple of occasions, called us out on a couple of things we did on the show and said, guys, this isn't going to work, and it's got to be better than this. But he's not saying that every day.
Right.
And that's why, like, when he speaks, you listen, and you respect what he says. and he knows the audience exceptionally well. So I think that's where it's different. Like, Spike's a little bit more laid back, but he'll let you know when there's a problem.
When it comes to developing an on-air style as a host, what do you think are the most important attributes a personality has to possess or work at?
I'm going to steal something from Clay Travis, because I'm constantly reading things from other hosts about what they do. I read a ton off of your stuff about just about all different aspects of it, and I try to remember this every day, but I've heard of something more on point. He wrote it recently, but it was about his approach to doing a show, and he uses the acronym SOFA: smart, original, funny, authentic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, those four things. Have those four attributes for your show and what you're trying to do every day. And I look at a list of things I've written down in my morning. Okay, what am I going to say here that's going to be smart, original, funny, authentic in different ways? The authenticity is the most important thing. Mark did not like me on the air until, like I said, you know, I had five or six or seven shows that were no good, and it was because I was too focused on sounding like I knew what the hell I was talking about. And I went in and did a show that thinking nothing was coming out of it anyway, and I'll just goof around and have fun. And the next day, he's like, this is exactly what I've been looking for. If you're yourself, and so trite, I know that, but it's the biggest truism there is. You have to be authentic.
All right, we're going to wrap up with a couple of quick hits. The first thought that pops to your mind to each of these four questions, okay?
Yep.
Biggest difference between New York and Philadelphia sports fans is?
New York can tune out every once in a while on some teams. Philly, when it comes to the Eagles, there's nothing like that in New York.
The percentage chance of Mike Francesa remaining at WFAN beyond 2017 is?
Had you asked me this question last week, the answer would have been different. I would say better than 50.
The most influential person on Chris Carlin's broadcasting career is?
Bob Beeler, the voice of the Boise State football team, taught me at Bucknell about preparation and just being able to carry a broadcast yourself.
And then finally, the greatest sports radio host in New York City history is who?
Chris Russo.
I'll make sure Francesa hears that.
It's very, very, very close, but I'm saying Chris just because Chris drove all aspects of the show.
Well, you can hear Chris Carlin weekday afternoons on Sports Radio WIP in Philadelphia. You could also find him on Twitter, at Chris Carlin, right?
Yes, sir.
Hey, man, this has been great. Really appreciate the insight into your career. Good luck with everything you're doing on WIP, and look forward to catching up again soon.
Thanks, Jason. I appreciate it very much.
This is the Barrett Sports Media Podcast.
My thanks again to Chris Carlin for his time. I thought his insight on working with Mike and the Mad Dog and navigating a difficult time on the Imus Show really stood out, as did his feedback on landing with WIP and looking at the opportunity as one that could become his final broadcasting stop. Given that mornings are open in New York and Chris is familiar with the market, that could be enticing. But it sounds like he's more than satisfied staying put where he is. If you host or produce a show, I hope you took note of Chris's views on interviews, because I hear this a lot on sports radio shows. You'll hear the guest start the segment and end the segment, and then there's little follow-up afterwards or no setup beforehand. It's even worse when the show moves on to a different topic in the next segment, because then there's no rhyme or reason offered by the host on why it was even on the show in the first place. When Chris talked about interview lengths being ideal at 8 or 9 minutes, how many times do you listen to a show and hear somebody stay on the air for 15, 16 minutes? Pace is a big deal. And not everything you talk to a guest about needs to be the history of their career. What are the three or four things you really need to get out of the guest, get them, and then get the hell out of there? But that brings us to the end of this episode. A reminder, I work as a sports radio consultant and analyst, and I'm available to help brands in need. My services and contact information can be found on sportsradiopd.com. Stations can also reach me there to arrange guest appearances on their shows. In the words of Kid Rock, if it sounds good, you'll hear it. If it looks good, you'll see it. If it's marketed right, you'll buy it. But if it's real, you'll feel it. So be authentic in everything you do. Until next time, I'm Jason Barrett. Thanks for stopping by.
I'd say that was a pretty successful broadcast.
Thank you for listening to the Barrett Sports Media Podcast. To stay updated on the latest sports media news, follow Jason on Twitter at SportsRadioPD and visit our website, sportsradiopd.com.